Hello and welcome to another edition of the Armchair Directors, where each episode we take a look at one of cinema's great directors and their essential films. This week on the show, we are looking at Ingmar Bergman and his 1957 classic Wild Strawberries. Returning on the show today to talk about Wild Strawberries, Professor Mike Giuliano. Professor Giuliano, welcome back to the show.
Great to be here.
So this is the 100th anniversary of Ingmar Bergman. He was born 100 years ago, back in 1918. And I've seen six of his movies so far, and most of his movies, I would say I respect them and, you know, admire them for the influence they've had on cinema and future directors. Like, for example, this is like one of Stanley Kubrick's all-time favorite films, but I respect and admire them more than, like, I like them personally. And it's kind of like, of the foreign directors from this age, I'd be more likely to pop in like a Kurosawa or an Ozu film more than a Bergman film. It's just like, it's more, I guess, for me on a personal level, it's there's something in there that, you know, that like Kurosawa films and Ozu films have more than this, than these movies. And it's not that I don't like them, it's just more of a personal thing for me.
Well, my personal taste isn't quite the same in that respect, but I'm respecting what you're saying in that Bergman can be intimidating in the sense that it's heavy duty, mm-hmm. it's Calvinist theology, it's not fun or meant to be fun sometimes.
Yeah.
No, I understand where you're coming from with that, and he sort of goes into that category of great directors that you have to admit, you have to admire are great, and yet in terms of personal taste, not everyone feels like, gee, I want to watch that again. You know,
yes,
it's like,
exactly.
It made me really depressed. Can I be depressed again next week? So there's that aspect of it, and also the fact that, you know, within the art house world, there are trends. There are things that over time change. I mean, Bergman was an art house favorite from the 1950s mm-hmm. into the 1980s, and then as he neared the end of his career and the end of his life, you know, people move on in various ways, and he became one of those pantheon directors that you know he's supposedly good for you. You know he's important, but
yeah.
Is he a director that you personally admire? Now, in my case, I do. That's where we diverge a bit in terms of personal taste, but I understand very much where you're coming from, because in any event, the larger picture is critical reputations will wax and wane a bit over time. In other words, for various reasons, because personal taste is important, and personal taste may have gone elsewhere in terms of art house, right? I mean, that's not just you. That's in general. It can happen that way. Some of the all-time great directors are great in textbooks, but how often do people watch the films and talk about them today? But specifically with Bergman, what I'd want to say is that because he was born 100 years ago, that kind of anniversary date is important. Let's put it this way. If you look at the art house circuit, what's left of it, the fact that as we speak, the Charles Theater in Baltimore this fall season has been programming Bergman films, a package of them, by way of having new prints, you know, restored prints on the big screen. And for many of us, it's revisiting older classics that we probably haven't seen for quite a while. But in other cases, as for yourself, let's say, it might be seeing the film for the first time or first time on a big screen, you know, see him that way. And it's so interesting that you mentioned Kubrick, and Kubrick did admire this film in particular quite a bit, because as we also speak about Bergman at 100, this is Kubrick's 90th. And, you know, just up the street from the Charles Theater in Baltimore, the Parkway Theater has been doing a whole series of Stanley Kubrick films this fall of 18, including
50th anniversary of 2001.
Yeah. They just had 2000, and particularly with 2001, you know, as it marks its 50th, and Kubrick's 90th, to have that on the big screen. And friends of mine who had seen it back in the day went, you know, to see it again after probably decades even to watch it again. So I think in terms of critical reputations, having that kind of an anniversary date is important. And you know what? Also, what happens, it's not just that the remaining art house circuit has a chance to celebrate on the big screen, but you do have newspapers, magazines, other things taking note, and it kind of prompts or prods people to remember, hey, here was a great director from back in the day who's still great. Whether you love him or simply respect him, that here's a director whose work should be seen again. And you know what goes along with that? And this is actually more pragmatic. Look at the gold standard of DVDs and now streaming, for instance, Criterion, where they will have, you know, a new print. They'll have a restored print put out. And they'll typically, by way of marketing, want to have some theatrical exposure for it, like what I just mentioned. But then, of course, in terms of DVD and streaming and so on, that you can see an old film looking as good now as it looked, 50-some years ago. And that's really an important point by way of what I call shelf value, that if you want to go back and rewatch or watch for the first time one of these films, you're actually seeing a good print, because many of us, frankly, grew up with muddy prints, tattered 16-millimeter prints of some of these films. So to see them restored that way really is a kind of splendid experience, particularly with Bergman, because the films are so well shot. He always worked extremely well with his cinematographers.
Yeah, and you can especially even see that sort of in like this dream sequence at the sort of beginning of the movie where the main character, Isaac, is having this dream where he's walking down the street. He sees this clock with no hands, and then he sees this mysterious figure that once he touches it, it just crumbles. And then he sees like this carriage that's carrying his casket, and then he sees his body in the casket. So you even see that with the cinematography, because it's really bright. It's extremely bright.
Yeah, Bergman, for the early half of his career, mostly worked with Gunnar Fischer as a cinematographer, and then after that with Sven Nykvist for many of his better-known later films. It's beautifully shot. For folks who haven't seen the film, Professor Isaac Borg is 78 years old. He's nearing the end of his life. He decides to go on a journey, and of course, metaphorically, it is a journey through life. And so the film itself is very metaphor-conscious, very symbol-conscious. So at the very beginning of the film, there's a dream sequence that, comes right out of the Sigmund Freud playbook, if you will. There's a lot of imagery there and associations. And even though the film is very clear in letting you know what's a dream initially and what's later on just simply him looking at locations and at people and recollecting his earlier life, it's very much a film of recollection. But very quickly, when you mentioned the carriage within that opening dream sequence, the fact that the actor playing Professor Isaac Borg is Victor Sjöström, one of the great early Swedish directors, mostly worked in the silent film period. And one of his best films, and it's really a great film, is called The Phantom Carriage from 1921.
Yeah, I was watching it. It's like, oh, that's got to be on purpose. That
reference. Yeah, oh, it absolutely is. It's overtly an homage, not just to, well, Sjöström's the star of the film, but of course the great mentor for Bergman in some ways. But the fact that if you watch Phantom Carriage and then watch Wild Strawberries, you see exactly which images in particular, the carriage and clocks and things like that, that Bergman is lifting from. The people talk about artistic influence, and the whole idea, and many people have said this, but if you're going to steal from the best.
Yes.
And Bergman felt that way, that he wanted to overtly acknowledge and honor the star of his film. We can talk more about Sjöström, of course, but just since you'd mentioned the carriage in the dream sequence, I thought it's got to be mentioned immediately then that this is not by happenstance.
Yeah.
This is very deliberate.
Yeah, and so we could talk a little bit about the character's name is Isaac, but it's played by Victor Sjöström, like you said, early pioneer of silent cinema. And not only did he do The Phantom Carriage, but I know he also came over here in like the 20s, I believe, and directed a few films here. One of them was with Lillian Gish.
Yeah, what's really curious is that Sjöström was from Sweden and spent almost all of his life there. But as a child, as an infant, really, his father brought him to Brooklyn, New York. You can't get more American than that. So part of his childhood actually was spent in America. Anyway, he made a lot of films in the silent film era. The Outlaw and His Wife in the late teens is one of the greats. Phantom Carriage, early 20s. Film after film, late teens, early 20s, really striking. And one of the most notable aspects of Sjöström then was that he loved to work on location, which typically was not the case. Most people were studio bound. Beautiful landscape cinematography. And so when you have films like Phantom Carriage and others, as you move through a dreamscape, you're also moving through actual landscape. It makes a difference. It's really quite moving in various ways. But what happened was then Hollywood was taking notice of major filmmakers in Germany, in Sweden, elsewhere, and invitations followed. To cut to the chase on that, Louis B. Mayer, MGM, personally invited Victor Sjöström to come to Hollywood.
Wow.
Sjöström, having directed all these silent Swedish films, made eight or nine at least, ballpark, eight or nine features in Hollywood. He worked with actors as lofty as Greta Garbo, Lillian Gish, and so on. When you mentioned Lillian Gish, he worked with her in 1926 on The Scarlet Letter from the Nathaniel Hawthorne. And then 2 years later, really one of the greatest silent films, I think, The Wind. with Lillian Gish in 1928, one of the great late silent films. And you realize just what a master he was as a filmmaker. What happened was his run in Hollywood, which was successful, ended at about the time sound came in. He was one of those directors who was so much a product of the silent cinema. He wasn't adjusting, I think it's on a very personal kind of psychological level, to the notion of sound film. So he returned to Sweden. He really only made a few more films. I think he directed his last film about 1937. And then after that, had a full career as a stage actor, a film actor, and a studio executive, Svensk Film Industry. So when Ingmar Bergman was entering the Swedish film industry in the very early 1940s, he would have certainly known Sjöström's work. And to quickly interject, when Sjöström was working in Hollywood, his name was anglicized. He became Victor Seastrom. You know, because who would go to see a movie with someone with a foreign name? So they tried to anglicize it that way. But anyway, back to Sjöström. When he was back in Sweden there, Bergman would have known him as a studio executive as much as anything. But he fully knew that early career when you earlier mentioned Phantom Carriage. You know, that certainly is in his memory bank. He knows all about that. But on a pragmatic level, Bergman's getting himself established as a screenwriter and then as a director in the early 40s. It's a small film industry in Sweden. He would have known Sjöström at that point in that day really as somebody on the other side of the desk, you know, calling the shots in terms of financing and filmmaking and all that. And then Sjöström actually had acted once for Bergman then in a relatively early Bergman film called To Joy in 1950. Again, playing a professor. He seems to have the professor of physique, if you will.
Elderly professor. Role,
yeah, yeah. A central casting for professors. He looks like one, doesn't he?
Yeah.
So anyway, he did that in 1950. And then when Bergman was doing Wild Strawberries in 57, just after Seven Seal, I mean, within months of it, it was not initially his idea to cast Sjöström. It was his producer. Bergman's producer said, "Hey, how about?" And the moment Bergman heard that, it was like the light bulb. You know, it was just like, "Oh my God, yeah, that's why not? It's such a natural." And then it went from there.
Yeah. And as you just mentioned, Seven Seal, and that they came out roughly the same time. I remember watching The Seven Seal, and there's even a one sentence little mention about like they're collecting wild strawberries. And I wonder if that was like on purpose that he was like, oh, I have this movie coming out as well.
Bergman has, it's a great observation. Bergman, partly because the films are made so closely together, and then, you know, particularly like in Seven Seal, where the knight, you know, played by Max von Sydow, you know, does enjoy wild strawberries and so on. And it's an image that is very much in mind there. What's interesting in terms of wild strawberries themselves, this might be the place to actually point out that in Swedish, the literal translation of the title would be Wild Strawberry Patch. And the reason that's significant, I think, not just by way of, you know, whether you speak Swedish or not, the reason it's significant is that in the film, it does matter that it refers to a specific location. This is very much a road movie about a man nearing the end of his road and his journey through life. And that it goes to actual places, and again, shooting on location, that you go to an actual patch of ground, and it's not just the studio back lot, you know. And so that it's not just the wild strawberries and all the images of innocence and purity and goodness, whatever represented by that, but an actual location for it. Also, but in terms of the proximity of it, this film to Seven Seal, one of Bergman's absolute best-known films and best films, Bergman was getting on the international map in the mid-50s. He'd been directing since the early 40s. Late 40s, early 50s, made a lot of movies, actually, mostly in a kind of naturalistic mode, or melodramatic even. Mid-50s, by way of more metaphysical concerns, he's really hitting his stride. And a kind of varied template. I mean, he was doing Smiles of a Summer Night, which is one of his gentler films.
Yeah,
but you know, mid-50s. Then, you know, of course, Seven Seal is the archetypal Bergman film. Just ask Woody Allen. But the thing is, as you mentioned, just a few months later, he's making this film, Wild Strawberries. So creatively, imagistically, there's crossover. So that you go from some of the, whether strawberries or other images from Seven Seal, and ruminations on death, on mortality and whatever comes next, if anything, Seven Seals obsessed with that. After all, it's the Middle Ages, and the plague has just come through, and people are thinking about death. And indeed, there's the figure of death to remind you of its presence. And then just within months of that, Wild Strawberries, a man in a very realistic film, but still with a dream sequence that's surreal deliberately, is thinking about death that way. And yet one further connection here, that the star of the Seven Seal, the knight who's confronting death and playing chess with it, is played by Max von Sydow, who actually has a cameo in this movie. And of all things, he plays a Texaco gas station attendant. I think Bergman does have a sense of humor. And he definitely does. And sometimes it's rather sly and maybe a little too subtle even, but somebody might, just watching the film, not recognizing him or not making the connection. But the fact that this is a story taking place in modern Sweden, not in the Middle Ages, so much so that you have not just a gas station, but Texaco.
Yeah. And even that scene, because he offers to pay for the fee, and they say no because he was a doctor before he became a professor, and they say there's some things that just can't be paid back. And is it referencing that he helped them in some way or helped that town in some way?
Yeah, that's a fair. I mean, you have to realize that he's a very esteemed figure. The character is that way because, after all, he's a retired academic. He's 78 years old. And by the way, the actor playing the professor was himself 78 at the time. So the character
Perfect.
And the actor have the exact same age, 78. Sjostrom's at that point. And it's kind of a double-sided tribute, or if that's the way to put it here, in the sense that. The professor is being honored. He's not one who likes to travel anymore, but he's received an honorary degree. And it's the sort of thing where you have to actually pick it up in person. You know, it's sort of like the Kennedy Center Honors or something. If you're going to receive it, you have to show up for it, right? They're not going to send it FedEx to you. And so he has to make that trip. And Bergman has him make the trip in a 1937 Packard. Now, to us nowadays, it might as well be a Roman chariot. It's so ancient, right?
Yeah.
But in the late 50s, that was already a really old car. And Bergman made the point that he very much should have a car that's as ancient as he is. And so that's part of the when I say humor here, I don't mean ha-ha, but just the sense that this is real. This guy is real. Like, 78 to us is not like, biblical patriarch. And yet back then it would have been old. And Bergman does his most to make it seem even older. You know what I'm getting at? It's as if, like 78 going on 90, going on immortality or mortality, however you want to look on these things. And so it's a really ancient car that he's going to travel in. Moreover, Sjostrom's own health at that point was starting to fail. Indeed, he would die in 1960, so he died 3 years after this film came out. And because he was in bad health, and also, frankly, because he had a really cranky personality, Bergman let him play himself in a lot of ways.
Yeah, it kind of fits well in this
movie.
Yeah.
I mean, when the professor looks like he's kind of irritated and out of sorts, he really was, actually. And that's quite striking within the film that there's not much distance between the actor and the character.
Yeah, and that leads a little bit into one of the complaints I sort of have with this film, and once again, the kind of which sort of makes me respect him more than like enjoy him personally, is films kind of always, like especially with this film, it's a bit, I guess, like say too ponderous, like some people say navel-gazing, where it's like you have the voiceover narration and he's constantly talking about his life, and you see that in a lot of the movies where they're they're overly pondering it's too introspective and a little bit too like they're questioning every little detail, and that's sort of one of the things that I still respect this film, but that's kind of what makes me respect it more than enjoy it personally.
Well, again, this is another instance of what we were talking about earlier, that when you talk about great directors, the Pantheon directors, sometimes in terms of popular taste, in this case art house taste, that does change over time. Bergman nowadays can seem not just serious, but self-serious, over-serious, ponderous, kind of pretentious that way, very literal-minded with his symbolism and so on. And he's playing hardball here, right? This is the way he approaches it. I think our taste nowadays, and this would probably be leading into like a 5-hour segment to really talk it through. I think we have a what I call a sort of snarky irony that we have a different outlook on things. We want films to be faster paced. We want people to be less serious and more joking or self-joking.
More superheroes.
Yeah. All those things. It's a whole different world, in many ways than what Bergman was operating in. And I'm not talking just about pop culture in terms of big box office films. I mean, even within the art house circuit, I think things have changed in that respect. But for Bergman, he takes it so seriously for some obvious reasons, which we've been detailing. And again, in terms of honoring Victor Sjostrom, to really, really have it as a serious homage with some bits of humor and irony, but as a really serious. And that would explain in terms of narration, the kind of somberness of it, the straight-on metaphysical inquiry and so on. You have to also realize, and this is something that may not be immediately apparent, the fact that Bergman is doing a twofold thing here in terms of the characterization. It's very much Sjostrom himself as much as the fictional character, Borg. But also, what's maybe not as immediately apparent is that Bergman looked on this as a somewhat autobiographical film. That he was, and Bergman was only 37 when he made it, but as if he were projecting himself forward. Let me explain. I'll explain by having Bergman explain what he meant by that. Late in his life, Bergman published a book. He published several books, but one of them is Images: My Life in Film. And he talked about making this film, but also what it was like to watch it years later. Because, you sit down late in life to write an autobiographical book, and you haven't seen one of your own films for a long time, right? So you watch it again. And so here's what he said about his re-encounter with the film. Quote, "I was deeply moved by Victor Sjostrom's face, his eyes, his mouth, the frail nape of his neck with its thinning hair, his hesitant, searching voice. Yes, it was profoundly affecting," close quote. Now, in that autobiographical book, Bergman notes that he was only 37 when he made Wild Strawberries. So initially, it might seem a little bizarre that a man so young is already thinking like an old-timer, that he's about to end his life. At the time, and even more so in later years, Bergman felt that the elderly Professor Borg reflected aspects of his own character. Indeed, the very name makes a connection. Think about it here. Ingmar Bergman, I.B., Isaac Borg, I.B. As Bergman wrote, this is from Bergman's book, quote, "Isaac Borg equals me. I.B. equals ice. And Borg is the Swedish word for fortress, hence ice fortress. I had created a figure who, on the outside, looked like my father, but was me through and through." Close quote.
Interesting.
And see, that also then doubles back on your observation that the film is so self-serious, so self-absorbed, kind of long-faced that way, because he's really thinking about Sjostrom as a mentor, about his own father, about himself. And Bergman, as a young man, philosophically, was already an old man.
Yeah, and I know, doing some research, this was written kind of during a difficult time in his life. I know he was going through a relationship breakup, and then because there's also a parent figure in his, because the professor's mom is still alive at 96, and I believe there was even problems he was having with his parents at that time, so you can kind of see that reflect into this movie.
Every period in Bergman's life was difficult. I mean, he was the son of a Lutheran minister. He had a really strict Calvinist upbringing. He had a lot to rebel against. And I think, he was always, always, always moody, always, thinking about such things.
He was the goth teen.
He would have been the goth teen, if you will. I mean, when you look at a lot of his early, look at his early films from the 40s and into the 50s, which are oftentimes relatively conventional in terms of narrative construction. It's a young man or a young couple and their struggles with early love and so on. Pretty straightforward and yet also kind of poetic as you sail through the passages of inland waterways in Sweden and so on. Beautiful but very moody. And the characters themselves oftentimes are really introspective, kind of borderline melancholic. I mean, this is a filmmaker at that time in his 20s with characters who reflect his own age and background. And these are not cheerful things. There are some exceptions to that along the way. I mean, we mentioned Smiles of Summer Night, and there's some others where he makes comedies, or at least by Bergman standards, a comedy.
I mean, Seventh Seal's actually pretty funny.
It's actually very funny. There's a lot of literally black humor in it. I mean, when you're playing chess with death and you're trying to outwit each other, he really does have a sense of humor there. But it's in fact, you can understand why, like Bill and Ted with their Excellent Adventure.
Yeah, I was about to say that.
Yeah. You can understand how it would feed into, and Woody Allen actually. in Love and Death and so on, how it would feed into certain narratives for other filmmakers. But through all that, even with those patches of humor, just how self-serious he always was there. And again, it triples back on what you were saying earlier about a director that some folks, you know, would admire without really actually loving all that much.
And even more, another character in the film I haven't talked about was B.B. Anderson, who kind of plays dual roles, because we see her as the character Sarah, who was this former love interest. And then we also see her as the young girl, Sarah, who she kind of accompanies on the road trip, who's kind of in this love triangle with these two guys. And once again, I believe at this time in Bergman's life, it was all, he was in a relationship with B.B. Anderson, and they were just breaking up.
Yeah, he had a history, if you will, of falling in love with his actresses, sometimes while still married to somebody else. And so I'm not going to defend them on those grounds, or that'd be another five-hour show. But the fact that...
That's kind of what they all did back in the 40s, didn't
yeah,
they?
Yeah, yeah, yeah. Give him a pass on that. But what I'm getting at, for Bergman, actually, when you read his biography and then when you watch the films, you realize how that dovetails. And to take it out of the personal and into the professional... in the sense that he had an acting troupe, and these people worked with him in theater and in film, and they stayed with him through the years. It's one reason why he was so prolific and so consistently good in that stretch. Both his technical crew and his actors were devoted to him. It was like a family of sorts. Mm-hmm. Not always a happy family, but they fought together as much as loved together. But to sort of segue into what you were mentioning there, in terms of the other characters in it, there's his daughter-in-law, Marianne, played by Ingrid Tulin, who's one of the regulars in his acting company. She is the one who actually accompanies the professor on the trip. There's the son, Evald, played by Gunnar Bjornstrand, who, again, another one of the regulars, and the longtime maid, Miss Agda, played by Julian Kindle. But what you had mentioned that I'll pick up on now at the moment is... Bergman loved to not only cast these important women, and he worked as a director. He worked with female actors, with actresses, as well as any director ever has. There's a real affinity between Bergman and the female actors. Again, because of these intertwinings of personal relationships and professional, they are really working intensely together. And mm-hmm. Again, oftentimes the difficulties of his personal life creatively could play to advantage in terms of getting some great performances and tension on screen. But again, back to your direct point, there are two very different characters who have the same name, Sarah.
Yes.
And both of them are played by B.B. Anderson. Again, B.B. Anderson is part of that regular company. And the Sarah we see in the past, because the film does, it has got that opening dream sequence, that surreal dream. But then throughout the film, like a lot of older people, particularly would in a case like this, you're traveling through the country. You're traveling through your own life, your own past. So the film in its structure has him in the present day on the road. But then you stop off at a house or wherever. And that prompts a flashback to the past. So anyway, the Sarah that we see in the past is the professor's cousin. The Sarah we see in the present is a hitchhiker accompanied by her two suitors, Anders and Victor. So all these romantic pairings and joustings there. But in terms of the casting, I mean, we mentioned Max von Sydow in terms, it's sort of like inside baseball casting, right? These people who work with you and they just pop up in some cases in small roles. In the scene set in the professor's childhood, Charlotta is played by a regular member of Bergman's acting company, Gunnar Lindblom. On a family note, one of the two young twins is played by Bergman's real-life daughter, Lena.
Interesting.
So, yeah, so the movie becomes a home movie at points. You know, if you have a flashback scene and you need some small kids, who's available? Mm-hmm. Well, hey, there's my daughter right over there. You know, put her on the lawn.
You're going to do it and like it.
Yeah, yeah, yeah. Let her pick up a wild strawberry or something. You know, put her in it.
Yeah, and not only you have the representation of B.B. Anderson as the Sarahs, but you also, like you said, it's a very metaphorical with the road trip. And you even see that with the fighting couple, where they pick up this couple who get in an accident, and even though they're just there for a short time, they're constantly bickering and they're very nasty towards each other. And I think it not only represents the way his son's relationship with his wife is, but only the marriage that the professor had with his wife that did not end very well.
You know, it's really good on a structural note to have that in the film, because on the one hand, it's important that this film has that one central figure and his immediate family and his present-day circumstances and the flashbacks and fantasies all adhering to him as the guy in the car, if you will, making a few pit stops along the road through life. By the same token, it's so close to him that way. What's structurally important, and I think breath of fresh air, or maybe not so fresh air, mm-hmm. in the film is that periodically you will encounter other characters. And you start to get parallels there. Like, you know, if this old guy's had his share of travails in terms of his family life, then when you have, you know, hitchhikers and others, whatnot, you could have younger couples who are already quite unhappy. Mm-hmm. They're on their road through life. And it actually factors into the kind of bleakness that can be a turnoff for some viewers, because although there are little bits of comic relief, I suppose, mainly Bergman's underscoring that, you know, it wasn't so great for me as I went through life through the surrogate character. And now look at these other younger people who should be relatively carefree and so on, but they're already settling into the same psychological patterns as older generations did, and so they're likely to have much the same outcome. And it's not the most cheerful thought, but the fact that Bergman can be brutally honest with things like that, he's not going to give us a Hallmark card.
No. And which is so interesting what you say, he's picking up hitchhikers. It's like almost one of the first examples, I think, of a road trip movie. And even like something like one of my favorite road trip movies is like Planes, Trains, and Automobiles. And like the road trip movie is, you start out with the people who go on this trip and they're vastly different than they were at the beginning. And you kind of can see it this movie where even he's sort of different than he was, I think, at the beginning, where he goes to get this lifetime achievement award. And he just kind of goes through the motions to get this degree. And you're not really sure if he finds peace at the end.
Well, as road movies go, it would have been quite a different film if somehow, bizarrely, as he picked up hitchhikers and whatever, it was John Candy or somebody got in the car. You know, that'd
saw them shower
that,
curtain rings.
Yeah, that'd be a very different film. Of course, one of the things that places, and of course, there had actually been a lot of earlier road pictures, though I think your essential point is correct, that as a genre, that's something that became more popular in later decades. And since, you know, Burt Reynolds just recently passed, it almost seems surreal to mention him in the same conversation as Bergman. But when you think of Smoking and Bandit type films, you know what I'm getting at, that's a format, or even, you know, like Road Warrior, anyway, we could go on for hours with that, but any number of films that essentially are road pictures, you can find earlier examples going back to the silent era. But I think you're essentially correct that as a genre, it's one where, and one reason is because it's a permissive format. By that I mean not just misbehavior, but also mean opportunities and side trips, you know what mm-hmm. I mean? It allows for, you can throw in almost anything in a road movie, right, and justify mm-hmm. it. And sometimes, it, you know, if an audience has a star to follow or a lot of special effects or both, it's an easy ride that way. Bergman makes it, of course, a difficult ride. And yet, somewhat lightening or leavening that is the fact that because it's being shot on location, there's some really beautiful sequences, just in terms of what you see in the woods or, you know, from the side of the road or whatever. And that offers, I would never call Bergman eye candy,
no,
in black and white or color. But the fact that in this Bergman film in particular, you really see the beauty of the countryside. To me, when I see that, I wonder, why are you people depressed? Just, you know, enjoy nature here. But you know, he's exploring human nature as they explore nature.
Yeah. Now that you said it, I want to see Ingmar Bergman's version of the Road Warrior. That would be interesting.
It would be even more frightening than the ones we have now.
And so, like, the ending shot of the movie, because, you know, he's accepted this Lifetime Achievement Award. He kind of was just going, like I said, he was just sort of going through the motions. It didn't seem like it meant a lot to him. But then he has this final vision of, like, you know, he's back at the house as a child. Sarah kind of leads him to where his parents are, and they're fishing out in this lake. And he has sort of the smile on his face. And sort of, does that sort of represent that, you know, even though he still has all these emotions and frustrations about his life, is maybe just gazing upon that part where he's fishing with his dad in a lake, is that sort of him finding peace and finding some sort of happiness and, you know, coming to peace with his life?
I think that's a fair summation, because, you know, through all of the angst, through all the family anxiety and flashbacks that aren't always pleasant, and people he picks up on the road who aren't always pleasant, through all that, he's coming to terms with his life as his life nears its end. And even though on the face of it, he's not exactly thrilled about getting this Lifetime Achievement Award, it's like the hassle of having to make the trip and, you know, who wants to pick up just a plaque or whatever. You know, he's kind of grouchy about all that. Still, you know, they are honoring him. They're acknowledging him. You know, you could have worse things happen to you, right? You know, mm-hmm. And so there, it kind of forces him, you know, by way of a formal award to, again, think through all these things. And at the very end of the film, to get to your point, I think he is, in many ways, just coming to terms. And I suppose the word I would use is a kind of acceptance. It's not quite the same as ear-to-ear smiling, but just simply in a bittersweet sort of way that it's been a long trip and a very full one, right? And a kind of closure that way. And ultimately, Bergman in his career, his final feature film, Fanny and Alexander, although he does go on to make movies for television and some other things that are filmed, his final theatrical release, or what was designed as a theatrical release, was Fanny and Alexander, a very long and very lush and very big budget kind of film in terms of Bergman really revisiting the world of his childhood. And even though many of his earlier films had looked at that kind of Calvinist upbringing, that kind of stern Lutheran upbringing as being really harsh and unhappy and so on, when you watch Fanny and Alexander, you realize that, you know, by the early 1980s, Bergman has kind of come to terms with or at peace with and can see it in a more nostalgic, sort of sepia-hued way. And I don't think that he's gone soft as a director so much as that, you know, that maybe life wasn't all so terrible. There were some good things there and fond memories. And he's kind of returned to all that. And I think in its own way, the ending of Wild Strawberries is a sort of premonition of the fact that, you know, as he nears the end of his own life, Bergman's life, he can look back more kindly on his past. And The Professor's doing something like that at the end of Wild Strawberries.
Yeah, and so we really, like I said, the whole movie is sort of this character, Isaac, looking back on his life and not only with the road trip. And, it, you know, one of the things I was asking myself is he like a good person? Because there are some moments where you don't think he's that good of a person. Like at the time when he goes on the road with his sister-in-law and she's saying like how cold and callous he was originally when she was like coming to him with the marriage problems. He's like, don't bother me with all of this. But then at other times you can see he has this charm and this endearment he has to people. Like he was with the young girl and her two lovers. And, you know, and it's almost like, you know, is he really a kind of a good guy? But because there's some parts in the movie where I felt like he could be really, he was pretty cold hearted at least.
He's not warm and fuzzy.
Yeah.
The thing is he's got a cold quality. He's got a formal control. He has a kind of cynicism. You might say it's just simply from all the years he's lived. He doesn't have the kind of sentimental trappings we might want, some beloved patriarchal figure.
Mm-hmm.
He's a very cold patriarchal figure that way. He's not typically endearing or approachable, and he can be so crusty. And of course, Sjostrom was like that. But you know what he's like then? He's like that. Most of us can think of somebody who's well up in age and sort of curmudgeonly.
Yeah, curmudgeon, crotchety.
Yeah. But people say, you know, he's essentially good at heart. And I'll say, well, I didn't see it. and this is sort of thing like, oh, but, you know, he doesn't like to show it, but it's there. He's that kind of a person where there are some acts of kindness. There's certainly intelligence. There is a certain sensitivity. He's aware of the feelings of others and so on. Whether he honors and acknowledges those is a different matter. But he's no dummy. He's aware of all these things. He has the capability of being a good humanist. And occasionally it outs or manifests that way. But you know, again, it's not going to be a big ear-to-ear smile at the end of the film. It's more a matter of, you know, he's had a chance to revisit people and locations from his life. And there have been some good deeds and conversations along the way. And a kind of coming to terms or almost peacefulness at the very end. But again, it's not going to be some conventional, you know, I've emerged a really happy person at the end. Because again, in Bergman, almost any character is going to be a complicated one with a mix of emotions and motives and so on. And even though in some of his films you could try to schematically say good guy or bad guy, most often those attributes are within the same person.
He's a jerk with a heart of gold.
That's one way to put it.
And watching this film, I was wondering if Bergman was somewhat influenced by Citizen Kane when making this, because there's definitely some similarities, I think, that there are with this movie. Both are sort of looking at this person's life. And, like, the big thing is, just like there's Rosebud in that movie where it's this time in his childhood when he was truly happy and he's never captured that since, it seems like the Wild Strawberries in that house is like the Rosebud in this movie where it seems like the part where he was truly happy, but once Sarah left him to be with his brother, it seems like that's just sort of when things went wrong. He had the bad marriage and everything sort of changed. It seems like the Wild Strawberries is the Rosebud.
When you look at film history, it's really a history in this respect, in terms of what you just said, that you have cinematic influences crossing the pond and then crossing back again. If you go to the 1920s in Germany, with all those great German films and how influential they were, and that many of the directors and actors, of course, would come to Hollywood and bring those influences with them. In terms of German expressionism, how that would influence very directly Universal horror films in the early 30s, film noir in the 40s, all that, sometimes again with the same personnel, you know, Billy Wilder and Peter Lorre and people like that actually coming over, so you have, you know, direct transmission that way. But those influences also go to other countries. So if you have that, and of course, you know, those films in Germany were so strong in the 20s at the same time that the early Swedish film industry was very strong. There's some cross-fertilization, and there aren't that many miles, if you will, between those two countries in terms of national film industries. You also have, you know, people need to remember that, for instance, Alfred Hitchcock really began in the British film industry early mid-20s, but his first film and his earliest I think, and most strongly felt influences were when he was in Germany in the mid-20s, film The Pleasure Garden and so on. Hitchcock was directly influenced by German Expressionism, so that when he went back to England and made films like The Lodger, you know, really early in his career, or Blackmail, those are films that directly reflect German Expressionism in terms of production design, lighting, philosophy, and so on. And you could say Hitchcock held on to those influences all his life. Certain Hollywood directors and genres definitely held on that way. So that, why do I mention that in terms of what you're saying? Well, when those influences come over to Hollywood in the 20s and 30s, a young Orson Welles is very alert and very sensitive to the nascent film history I'm talking about. And when Welles I actually have a what amounts to a student film. The Welles was not a student in any conventional sense because he dropped out of every school he ever went to. But as a young man, he sort of made like a backyard home movie in the early 30s. It's just a left-hand exercise. It's a toss-off. But it very directly shows the influence of German Expressionism. Then when he made his first feature film, when you watch Citizen Kane from 1941, how can you not think about German Expressionism in terms of production design and lighting and so on? And that even though it's strictly speaking not a film noir, it has attributes of one, okay? A detective story, and some of the characters are right out of central casting for film noir. and then if you just jump ahead a few years, you do have film noir, properly speaking. So you have Orson Welles absorbing influences like that in a film that comes out in 1941. That film's extremely influential, needless to say, for other directors who were coming along at the time. So Ingmar Bergman was a cinephile. He would have known earlier, he certainly knew the earlier Swedish films, not just Sjöström's. He certainly knew the German films from the 20s. He certainly knew Hollywood movies from that period because they were all released in Sweden. So not surprisingly, when Bergman starts to make his own films, initially as a screenwriter, then as a director, you can see those influences feeding in. And I would sometimes more strongly in one film than another, but you could point to some Bergman films and then hold up an earlier example like Citizen Kane. And again, there's many differences and similarities, but you can sometimes, like in production stills, a shot from a Bergman film, a shot from Citizen Kane, you know what I'm getting at, you can actually sort of line them up sometimes saying, well, not that it's not copycatism. It's just simply that you are the end product of everything you've absorbed.
Yes.
And you've seen these things. And yeah, it's going to influence how you make a film.
Yeah, it's kind of like a Tarantino almost, but less copycatish.
Well, again, I hadn't expected to use that name in a conversation about Bergman, but the short answer is yes.
Well, even like, I guess when we're talking about influence, I know probably in America, I think the one person who's been most influenced by the work of Bergman would have to be Woody Allen, because like you said, there's that scene in, I think, Love and Death, one of his early films, where they're directly parodying one of his movies, and it just seems like in interviews and everything, he's always like mentioning Bergman. It seems like probably Bergman was the biggest influence when Woody Allen was starting out making movies.
Well, again, in the early 70s, Woody Allen was making movies that are really silly and really loosely constructed.
Those are the ones I like.
You know, remember like when he made Stardust Memories in 1980, he was making more self-serious Bergman-esque films at that point. And of course, there's that hilarious. And in Stardust Memories in 1980, Woody Allen plays a film director who's always being pestered by his fans and critics and this and that. And there's the scene where he's actually even visited by Martians from outer space who come down and they tell him they prefer his early funny movies to the more serious. So he's taking grief from everybody, right? Yeah. But when you look at Woody Allen's movies from the very early to mid-70s, you get to about 1975 or so, Love and Death. Ostensibly, the principal satirical target would be, Tolstoy, the great Russian literature, and having fun with Dostoevsky and Tolstoy and all that, because it really is, Love and Death is set during the Napoleonic period, and on the surface, to the extent that it has a coherent structure that involves, spoofing the era that Tolstoy was writing about, in War and Peace specifically. And it's a very funny film. I like it that way. But then throughout the film, Woody Allen tosses in all sorts of things. Almost like you get a funny idea, it goes in the movie.
Yeah.
And so you actually do get, the figure of death with the scythe and the hourglass and all that. And of course, by the end of the film, that's going to be very prominent within the film. And that's where, anyone in America, not just on the art house circuit, but anyone going to see a film like that in the early, mid-70s, would have some familiarity with the Seventh Seal.
Yeah.
They might not have even seen the film, but there are a few iconic images from it that have percolated into pop culture. And so when Woody Allen not just alludes to it, but wholesale lifts that from, he's having a lot of fun with that. On a more serious level, he greatly admired Bergman, and there was the more serious side of Woody Allen's personality, and they actually on a personal level did get to know each other. Bergman visited New York and talked with Allen, and they had that connection. Allen, in interviews and in his own writing and in several of his films, is very, very direct about talking about that real strong influence from Bergman. And you could say there are a handful of Woody Allen's films that are essentially Bergman films, but with American dialogue.
Mm-hmm.
When you get to like 1978 with Interiors, the cinematographer is Sven Nykvist, Bergman's cinematographer. The configuration of sisters in that film is something that was a lot to Chekhov, but also a lot to Bergman. There are a lot of close-up shots, side-angle profile shots, and so on, that are really Bergman-esque. They're lift. You could substitute, Leve Ullman's face for Diane Keaton's or something. It's that close. And that's a very self-serious, very ponderous film. I remember when that came out, this is Interiors, Woody Allen's Interiors, when that came out in 78, I reviewed it. I was, writing for a newspaper. I reviewed it. And I think I was one of about five critics in America that liked it, and everyone else hated it. And I took so much grief on that. But I really did love that film. Though, again, it might be a film that's easier to respect than to love. Mm-hmm. I really did like that film for the rigor of it. He's just stubbornly going to make a Bergman-esque film, and it's just beautifully done at that level, whether one cares for that or not. And having seen it and used it in courses more recently, I still really admire that film. But I know it's an eternally polarizing film. People tend to love it or hate it. There's not too much middle ground on that. Maybe that's why I dig in my heels when I say I really like it. Because, there are times in life where you feel like you're the only guy in the room who liked a film.
Yeah.
And everyone else is dumping on it. And it's, what do you do? It's like somebody's attacked your favorite child, right?
Yeah.
So you say, no, it's a wonderful. So maybe even oversell it a bit, right? Just because you've dug in at that point.
So what? Going, because I remember I saw his most recent film, Wonder Wheel, and I thought that film was just awful. What did you think about that movie?
I thought it was terrible.
Good.
What I liked about it actually was, and this is something that's a saving grace in his most recent films, I think, are uneven. Some I like quite a bit, others not so much. I really didn't like Wonder Wheel at all. It's so self-serious, and it's so ponderous, and it's so static at times, and so unconvincing. And you know what? Even though Allen's known for working really well with his actors, and he's got, dozens of films to prove that.
Yeah.
In Wonder Wheel, I felt like the actors had just met. They're acting at each other, not with each other.
Yeah.
So it's dramatically inert. However, the saving grace of it is that in terms of production design, cinematography, the physical production, it's a beautifully made evocation of what Coney Island would have been like back in the day. And it's just, so I ended up watching it, and to the extent that I enjoyed anything, it was just simply to see the set design and the exquisite lighting.
Just put it on mute.
It's really beautifully made, but it's just totally dramatically dead. It just doesn't work at all there. And I don't think all the blame for that should be put at Bergman's doorstep.
Oh, no, definitely not Bergman's
fault. But no, it's not his fault. Give him a break on this one. He was no longer with us. He's not 100 years old now. But the thing is that that's that serious side of Allen's that I think sometimes works extremely well, and sometimes you're right. Sometimes, frankly, just, there are some of Woody Allen's chamber dramas from the 80s that are claustrophobic. You know, and friends and I have argued about this because, again, some of them, Shadows and Fog, films like that, I just think I want to open a window and let in some air. Mm-hmm. There's some films like that, but some of those I actually do like, so I can't be categorical there. I think when he works in a Bergman-esque mode, sometimes it works well. And I don't think, actually, Wonder Wheel is a particularly Bergman-esque film.
I just brought it up because
what it fits in more is Woody Allen has a strong nostalgic bent, which when it pays off big time. You know, you think of Radio Days any number of films where he's revisiting the world of his youth or you know, at least of decades a few back. And sometimes those are wonderful films. I love the fidelity to period detail and just the love of period and so on. And Wonder Wheel, to some extent, it is looking back at an earlier time in New York, specifically Coney Island-type atmosphere. And so when a film like that doesn't work, the only thing you're left with is production design and cinematography. And, you know, and he's a master at those things now, which is really quite striking because his early films are anything but that. The earliest films are so sloppy.
Yeah, Bananas.
Oh, Bananas. I love Bananas.
That's a great movie.
I love Bananas, but I think a 12-year-old kid could have directed it better. You know what I mean? It's really sloppy, but that's actually why I like
it.
You
know,
why it works. I'm not making fun of it that way. I love it for that reason, but you would never give it awards in technical categories.
No. So we can move a little bit back to Ingmar Bergman. Talk a little bit more about his work. The two films of his, I'll tell one interesting little story first. I do also do a sports show here on the radio station with Matt, and we kind of do a running bet every year with picks for football games. And anyway, a couple years ago, I won a bet, and we always make each other watch a movie that we think the other is going to hate. So I made him watch The Seventh Seal because it's this foreign film from has subtitles. I thought he's just going to hate this. And he actually quite enjoyed it, up to my surprise.
I thought you were just being a sadist with that, but it was for his own good, right?
Yeah, and he was like, oh, I actually thought it was really funny. He actually thought a lot of the scenes were funny, so that was interesting. But the two Bergman films I think are his most interesting. One was Persona, because I think that's one of those movies you could talk about, like, well, what does this represent? Are these people the same? Are they two different characters? And another one I thought was really interesting he did was Hour of the Wolf, which I think is one of the most misleading titles ever in movies, because there's no wolves at all in the movie. But it's a really interesting horror movie, which you don't really think of when you think of Bergman.
And it lasts longer than an hour, right?
Yeah. So,
on all those levels. It's actually one of his underappreciated films. I mean, it got a lot of attention when it first came out. But there's an example. Within a Pantheon director's career, some titles get mentioned more than others. There are some Bergman films of that period, like Hour of the Wolf or Shame, some of those, which actually are well worth watching again. Mm-hmm. Some others maybe not, like when he did his English language debut with The Touch, starring Elliot Gould, you know, terrible film. But that's a period, that's sort of like middle period Bergman, where some of the films hit and I think some of them miss. But those films from that particular several-year period don't get mentioned all that often nowadays. Now, my own vote, I mean, Bergman made so many great films, I hate to be put on the spot, but when I put myself on the spot, like what are his greatest films? Certainly, you know, Seventh Seal, Smiles of a Summer Night. But as you move into the maturity of the career, or at least into that next decade, 60s into the 70s and so on, my vote would go to Persona from 1966. Mm-hmm. I mean, if I had to say what's his single greatest film, one reason why it's so powerful has to do with the acting, of course, with Lee Ullman and B.B. Anderson. When you have actors of that caliber, that directly relates to the storyline, namely, you know, the most fundamental questions about personae, about personality, about identity. If you have a patient and a nurse, if you have two people in close proximity and personalities that might actually even merge, and the brilliance of when Bergman actually technically has the images merge so that, you know, one face and the other, in a sense, become the same. And it's just, you know, spellbinding. And again, that's a case of a director who's pushing it to the limits. In other words, Bergman as an almost, I would say, experimental filmmaker.
Yeah, it's
at that
very
point.
Experimental.
It is, isn't it? And it's also very self-reflexive in a way we like nowadays, at least in cinephile circles, that it's a film about filmmaking as much as anything, where you're consciously aware of the film frame itself. And how sometimes things become so intense, you feel like the film's going to break apart, quite literally.
Yeah, especially with that opening sequence where you don't even know what the heck is going on. You see like this kid, and you see like all these various images popping up, and it's sort of, and he does that a few a few parts in that movie.
Again, that's the case where the filmmaker is so rigorous, so relentless, that he'll take it wherever it's going, and it becomes almost unbearable in all sorts of ways how far he'll push it. So that's certainly on my short list of great Bergman films. And, of course, a little bit after that, Cries and Whispers from 1972, which, again, is a very different film in terms of being in color and a kind of lushly mounted period piece. But in terms of how spare it is in its own way, a very reduced color palette where it's, you know, red, white, black, really not much color beyond that, but a really kind of relentlessness there in terms of taking it down to a few characters in really kind of stridently minimal settings. And again, that's partly because of the powerhouse acting. I mean, performance is so strong. And the only reason I don't watch those two films more often is just that they drain you. They're overwhelming. So if I'm sitting home thinking, let me watch one of the older films, you know, I've got on the shelf, whatever. Yeah, if I watch them, I'd be knocked out all over again. It's just like, do I want to have a nervous breakdown tonight? Yeah. You know, it might be easier to watch something else instead.
Yeah, it's not like, hey, let's get together and watch a Bergman film. It's not one of those.
Well, even as much as I love Bergman, it you know, I'm not always in the mood to sit down and put myself through
You got to get in the right kind of mood for
I've got to hide the razor blades first.
And one other film I forgot to bring up I thought was really good. It's Autumn Sonata. This is the film he did with Ingrid Bergman, no relation. But I think that was also a really solid film he did.
Well, I'm so glad you mentioned that because the two great Bergmans.
I always get them mixed up. I'm always going to get them mixed up, too.
To get you even further mixed up, near the end of his life, when he had something resembling domestic comfort with yet another wife, his final wife's name was Ingrid. Oh. And so he was married to Ingrid Bergman, but she was always there. Imagine you're the other Ingrid Bergman, right?
Yeah.
But when you look at the actress Ingrid Bergman, she had done a lot of good work actually in the Swedish film industry. There's some really good DVD compilations where if you want to look at Ingrid Bergman before she came to Hollywood, you can see her in films like Intermezzo in 1936. She was only 21 years old, and she's making that film in Sweden. She's on the brink of stardom, and you really see in terms of her physical presence and what she can do in a film. And that's a case of a film that, of course, Hollywood's going to remake, but you can see how they're always scouting talent, right? Mm-hmm. And they see her as a really beautiful young actress. So not just that they're going to bring Ingrid Bergman to Hollywood, but that they're going to actually, you know, remake that film, and then other films where, in terms of Hollywood melodramas, mm-hmm. it crosses over pretty readily. So those films are themselves readily available in restored prints, and you can see that some of the they're very typical of Swedish dramas of that period. But if those particular films hold up well, it's because you look and think, my goodness, that's Ingrid Bergman, and you know, she's got it already.
Yeah,
in her early 20s. So anyway, back to your point that. Those films were seen here. She was brought over, of course, by the early 40s. She's one of the major Hollywood stars. There's the 1939 remake of Intermezzo, where she's co-starring with Leslie Howard. From that into the mainstream Hollywood movies that we know her for, like Casablanca in 42, Gaslight, Anastasia, and so on, that full career. Now, Ingmar Bergman and Ingrid Bergman, the actress, not the wife, that Ingrid Bergman, they talked for years about making a movie together. It finally happened with Autumn Sonata in 1978. Incidentally, when they made this movie, Ingmar Bergman was married to the fifth and final wife, the other Ingrid. So you can imagine in conversations how confusing that must have been. I've got Ingrid holding on the line here.
Let's go to the flowchart here.
Yeah, flowchart. Which Ingrid is this? During interviews, in fact, the Swedish director would avoid confusion by referring to them as Ingrid the actress and Ingrid the wife. So they knew their roles. The great star and the great director, they really respected each other's work, but they got off to a terrible start during the first few days of the shoot. Ingrid Bergman criticized aspects of Ingmar Bergman's script during an early cast meeting. Can you imagine the temerity of that? Mm. You don't do that to Ingmar. Even if you're Ingrid Bergman, you don't do that, but you can imagine how testy it was. Ingmar Bergman criticized Ingrid Bergman's acting, which he felt was a showy star performance right out of the 1940s. After a shouting match in a studio hallway, they settled into a productive working relationship. The actress essentially deferred to Bergman's script and also his approach to acting. If the director had an especially short temper during this period, it's because this was a difficult time in his personal life, dovetailing back on what you were saying earlier. His romantic life was in turmoil. His financial life was even worse. The director was living in self-imposed exile in Germany after Swedish government officials charged him with tax evasion. Very difficult period in his life. Although he was acquitted of those charges and the Swedish government officially apologized, the director stayed abroad for a few more years. That's why Autumn Sonata was shot in Norway. Okay, and speaking of Norway, Liv Ullmann, who co-stars with Ingrid Bergman in it, playing the daughter, she actually was originally from Norway. And then the other principal cast members, Erlend Josephson, who was in so many of Bergman's films, Scenes from a Marriage, of course, other films with Liv Ullmann. What happens there is that they all give exceptional performances. So that creative tension, I think, ironically, almost played to advantage there. Indeed, Ingrid Bergman was nominated for an Academy Award as Best Actress. On a more somber note, I've got to add, she was already sick with the cancer that would end her life, and Autumn Sonata was her final feature film.
Didn't she win for Murder on the Orient Express?
Yeah, supporting actress.
Okay, make sure. All right, getting close to the end of my questions here. Is there anything else that you want to bring up or talk about Ingmar Bergman or anything?
Well, again, the fact that it's his 100th anniversary year and a great time to recall him, and on a shamelessly self-promotional note, that
right ahead.
Next semester I'll be teaching my course on Scandinavian film, and directors like Victor Sjöström and Ingmar Bergman obviously are on the list. They're in my pantheon.
All right. Okay, well, that wraps up this episode of The Armchair Directors. We have been discussing Ingmar Bergman and his 1957 classic Wild Strawberries. Don't forget, you can listen to The Armchair Directors every Tuesday at 9:30 a.m., Sunday at 2:30 p.m., or anytime at dragondigitalradio.podbean.com under the category Armchair Directors. Tune into Dragon Digital Radio to hear the show a week before it's on Podbean. Professor Giuliano, I want to thank you again for coming on the show today.
Thanks so much.
For The Armchair Directors, I'm your host, Alex Baker, saying, when you were little, you believed in Santa Claus. Now you believe in God. We'll be right back.